I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The United Farm Workers, which was founded in the 1960s in California's Central Valley, became one of the most transformative labor organizations of the 20th century. At its height, with over 50,000 members, the UFW won many labor victories and secured collective bargaining rights for California farm workers. In the late 70s, lettuce workers in Salinas Valley made $12 an hour, or almost $50 an hour in today's wages, making them among the highest paid members of the U.S. working class. But by the 1990s, the UFW had essentially disappeared from California's fields. And look where we are today. According to the U.S. Department of Labor's National Agricultural Survey, in 2005, 75% of individual farm workers and 52% of farm worker families earned less than $15,000 a year. Tracy McMillan, author of Undercover on the Front Lines of Dinner, was recently on our show. And when she worked undercover on California farms, she made between $2 and $4 an hour. That's $2 and $4 an hour. Farm workers are some of the most exploited workers in the country today. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about how we got here after so many UFW successes. How are farm workers organizing today? We have seen several victories this year. How can we support them? In his new book, Trampling Out the Vintage, Cesar Chavez and the Two Souls of the United Farm Workers, Frank Bardaki traces the rise and fall of the United Farm Workers and its most famous leader, Cesar Chavez. The book is based on many, many years of interviews with farm workers, organizers, and staff of the UFW. Frank Bardaki was active in the student and anti-war movements in Berkeley in the 60s. He moved to California's Central Coast in 1970, worked for six seasons in the Salinas Valley fields, and spent 25 years teaching English to farm workers in the Watsonville area. And Frank joins us from Watsonville. Hi, Frank. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, congratulations on this book. It took you about 15 years to write.
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. It took me a long, long time. I never would have started it if I'd known how long
Well, you know, a lot of the reviews I've read say that they're so glad you finished this book. It's 740 pages without all the notes. It goes up to 800 with the notes because you did bring a lot of new information to the table. Obviously, there are so many books about the UFW, a lot of documentaries. But in your book, you really do focus on the farm workers and the power that they had in organizing. First off, let's talk about your overall goal in undertaking such a massive project.
Well, the sad truth is that the history of the UFW as it is written is basically a history of the UFW staff, and that that what happens is the UFW history kind of becomes reduced to an aspect of the biography of Cesar Chavez and the people around him. When, in fact, there were, as you said, tens of thousands of workers inside the UFW, and to a large extent what the UFW won was a result of the organization and the movement of those workers. And so what I really wanted to do was to sort of talk about the world of work and the communities that those workers came from. And when, as a matter of fact, when I started the book, one of the reasons it took me so long, when I started the book, I was just going to talk about farm workers and farm workers in the inside the UFW. But as I went along, that kind of became another kind of distortion. So what I really had to do was talk about the relationship between the top staff, especially, and the farm worker rank and file, and it's the dynamic of that relationship which really is the core of the book.
Right, and we'll talk about this later. But you talk about the struggles within the UFW, the relationship between Cesar Chavez and workers and undocumented workers. That's fascinating. So when you look at the workers, what, when you interviewed them, especially the workers that were in the fields back in the 60s and 70s, what was the main story they wanted you to tell?
Well, they wanted me to talk about their movement and what happened to their movement. But the thing that you have to even begin with before you begin with their movement is you have to have some appreciation of farm worker power. Because in one, to a certain extent, or to a large extent, farm workers are understood by the general population as being poor, suffering, powerless people who in the 1960s and 70s were reaching out to their allies for help. In fact, farm workers have a lot of power, and the power is essentially is based on two essential facts. The first is that farm workers have not been mechanized out of existence. If you talk about the farm workers who built the UFW, they worked in the fresh vegetables and in fresh fruit, and that those jobs have not been mechanized. So farm workers are people who work with tools in their hands. They don't work along an assembly line. And it's very difficult to learn those jobs. It takes years to learn those jobs. Anybody can go out, say, and pick an apple off a tree or pick an orange off a tree. But to work on an apple crew and to keep up with an apple crew and to pick enough apples to make even the minimum wage, you have to be a skilled worker. This was especially true of the lechugueros, the people who picked and packed lettuce. This is a highly skilled work. You work for 4 or 5 years to become a skilled lechuguero. And they also not only were skilled, but worked together in crews where this crew stayed connected to each other. The crew stayed intact year after year, and these crews were paid collectively so that the crew would be paid a certain amount of money for a box of lettuce, and then the crew would split it among themselves. So these crews were highly skilled. They had a lot of internal solidarity. They stayed together over years. They also very often were relatives or people from the same hometown in Mexico. You would have brothers, cousins, even fathers and sons who worked together on these lettuce crews. So these lettuce crews, there are about 3,000 of them in Salinas Valley in the 1970s. These lettuce crews were very powerful people. And when they went out on strike, they never broke up. Either the crew went out on strike together or the crew stayed together working. They never split. So they were very powerful, and they could only be replaced by similarly skilled workers. So this was the basis for a lot of the UFW's strength in the Salinas Valleys in the 1970s. So that's the first thing, that they're skilled. The second thing is growers are very vulnerable during a harvest because all of the money that they've invested, all of the money that they invested during the year is tied up in that harvest. And if they miss the harvest because of bad weather or because of a strike, they can't recoup their losses. It's not like in a factory where you could, like, warehouse the materials and then bring people back to work after the strike and work them triple shifts. So the combination of skill, the collective strength of these crews, and the vulnerability of the growers during the harvest gave farm workers a lot of strength in the 1960s and 1970s.
You know, it's amazing when you're talking about the skill. A lot of people realize what goes on on the farm. A lot of people probably haven't been to one of the farms, especially those of us who live in cities. And this is sort of coming out with the laws in Alabama, the anti-immigration laws in Alabama. And a lot of these farm owners are talking about the fact that they can't find people to pick the blueberries or to pick the melons because, first of all, it's backbreaking, really hard work. Mm-hmm. And second, people don't have the skills, and so they'll last a couple hours and say, I can't do this.
That's exactly right. I mean, Alabama lost their whole melon harvest.
Right.
You know, and, you know, picking a watermelon, that to many people, that doesn't sound like that hard a thing to do. But to pick them quickly, to choose which melons are ripe and which melons you're supposed to leave behind, to throw the melon to the person who's packing it, it's all a very difficult, hard job. Not only that, but there's a skill involved in being able to work hard all day long.
Mm-hmm.
That's something people don't acknowledge either. That's farm workers generally have been working in the field since they were children in Mexico, and they know how to work hard all day. A lot of people cannot do that. So, yeah, Alabama lost the whole melon harvest because after those draconian anti-immigration laws, so many farm workers left the state that they didn't have enough people to pick the melons. And even though they paid fairly high wages to try to attract people, they couldn't find the people who could do the work. This happened very often in the UFW years in Salinas. One of my favorite stories about California agriculture is in the 1970 strike, when all of the apieros, those are people who cut and pack celery, when they went out on strike and stayed out on strike, all of this celery was going to waste. So the growers decided that they would have a day in which they would pick and and cut and pack the celery. Well, they were smart. Growers are smart, and they knew that they probably couldn't do it. So they called on a couple of contractors to bring out a couple of celery crews to do the work, and they would be there kind of helping. And about 20, 25 growers and supervisors showed up. But the contractors at that time, when the strike was very powerful, were afraid of the UFW and didn't want to anger the UFW because they were afraid that the UFW would put them out of business after the strike was over. So they didn't show up. So it was just this 20 to 25 growers, their wives, and supervisors. But they had told all the press that they were going to do it, that they were going to pick, cut and pack the celery, so they just felt obligated to go out to the fields and do the job. Well, they went out to the fields with these newsmen, television cameras, and they worked for about 3 hours, and they couldn't cut and pack a single box of celery. Not a single box.
Wow. You know, in the beginning of your book, it's amazing when you write about how much money farm workers made. You write, it may be hard to imagine that celery workers in the 1970s made what would be about $50 an hour in today's economy. Piece rate lettuce cutters and melon pickers made even more. People who tied rubber bands around cauliflower leaves to protect the flowers from the sun made quite a bit more. These people working seasonally earned annual incomes comparable to those of other well-paid, unionized U.S. workers. So $50 an hour in today's wages. And as I mentioned in the intro, I'm not sure if you've heard of Tracy McMillan's new book, Undercover on the Front Lines of Dinner. She goes undercover to Applebee's, Walmart, but she also worked undercover on California farms.
Uh-huh.
And she was just on our show last week, and she made between $2 and $4 an hour.
I'm interested, what crop did she work in? Do you remember?
I don't remember. I think it was a variety of crops. But, you know, hearing her talk about that and then reading your book, it's amazing when you think about how far or how we got here. So first off, let's talk about what was the most effective way these farm workers organized? How were they able to make $50 an hour in today's economy?
Okay. Before we do that, I want to make an attempt at explaining Tracy's $2 to $4 an hour.
Okay.
Okay. Just for a second, and then I'll talk about the next question. It took me about 6 years to be an average farm worker, just a below average farm worker. That's because of the skill that's required that I talked about before. If you work piecework, if you're working piecework and you're an inexperienced farm worker, you know, you're lucky to make $2 an hour. So I'm not sure whether she worked piecework or not. I imagine that that's how that happened because there's so much skill involved and because the wages have fallen so far. I'm not denying that the wages have fallen. For the entry wage in the Salinas Valley these days is minimum wage. If you get on a good piece rate crew, maybe you can make $10 an hour. But that's where I think the $2 to $4 an hour comes from. And it's undeniable that farm workers are very, very poor again. Now, how did the UFW reverse that? Well, the first thing is to understand that the skill of the farm workers and the vulnerability of the growers during harvest time. And what the UFW did, and actually quite brilliantly, was they linked that temporary power that farm workers have during the harvest to more long-term institutional power by linking farm workers to their allies in the cities. So that what the UFW represents is that is the ability to, through boycotts, to have consumers and students and liberal clergy and labor unions put added pressure on the growers to sign union contracts. And when you linked those two, when you linked the support from the allies in the cities to the temporary power that farm workers have, then that was a formula for success. And that's how wages got driven up so high.
We're speaking with Frank Bardicke about his new book, Trampling Out the Vintage, Cesar Chavez and the Two Souls of the United Farm Workers. Frank traces the rise and fall of the UFW and its most famous leader, Cesar Chavez. Cesar Chavez Day is this Friday.
Mm-hmm.
The book is based on several years of interviews with farm workers, organizers, and the staff of the UFW. And we'd love to hear from you. What do you remember about the UFW? What did you learn from them and their struggle? And at its height, UFW had over 50,000 members. And then by the 90s, it had essentially disappeared from California's field. So what do you remember about the rise and fall? What really stands out for you? And then we're also talking today about how farm workers are organizing today. We'll talk about a few victories involving Trader Joe's and the Immokalee workers. And how can we support farm workers? How much attention do you pay to this issue? Do you talk with farmers about this issue? We're really going to talk about what average citizens can do in this area. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you work on a farm, we'd love to hear from you. If you visited a farm, what stood out for you? And then we'd also love to get you to talk about the legacy of Cesar Chavez. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Now, Frank, again, you've got about 700 pages of history in your book, and it's a big question to really ask you. How did we get to a point where farm workers are making so little money? And also, farm workers in California right now are trying to raise enough money to take buses to Sacramento to fight for a new bill, AB 2346, which is the Farm Worker Safety Act. And it would prevent farm workers from dying in the summer heat. It would allow them to be able to enforce mandatory shade and drinking water requirements by taking delinquent employers to court. I mean, it speaks volumes that we have to actually fight for a bill that prevents workers from dying from the heat in 2012.
Yes, it does. It speaks volumes, as you say. The question, I mean, what has happened with the UFW is what the UFW has become is kind of an advocacy group, a farm worker advocacy group, and which is useful. I mean, it's good to have farm workers to have advocates. And so that they do most of their activity is to put pressure on the legislature to pass a protective legislation. But of course, the protective legislation has to be enforced. One of the things that happened in the midst of the farm worker movement was the short handled hoe was banned. That was a terribly important victory. But as farm worker organization and as a declined and as the farm worker movement petered out, The short-handled hoe has been reintroduced into the California fields. You drive around where I live, and you can sometimes see people working with short-handled hoes or what they call weeding knives, which is a short-handled knife which requires people to be bent over. So it's very important. I'm all for these laws, but I think the laws are not as much protection as farm workers' ability to protect themselves through their own movement and their own organization. And that, I think the bigger question behind what you're asking is kind of what happened. How did the UFW go from being so powerful to having maybe less than 5,000 people in the California fields today?
Right.
And that's a big question. It took me about 746 pages to answer it. And it's a complicated question. It's not really a question of assessing blame. It's a complicated historical question, and it's sort of hard to summarize it, but I'll do my best here. One of the main things that happened, as I described to you, was that that the secret of or the key to farm worker to UFW power was this linking the farm workers in the fields and the power that they have with the longer term power of the workers' allies in the cities. And that's the famous grape boycott, if you may remember. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're old enough to remember, but maybe some of your listeners out there are old enough to remember the grape boycott in 1965 to 1970. And that grape boycott was so powerful that even though there were enough people in the fields picking the grapes, and the growers had no problem with production, the boycott was so powerful that it forced the growers to sign contracts with the union. That experience of the power of the boycott certainly did sort of twisted the orientation of the United Farm Workers Union. So what happened in the United Farm Workers Union is the boycott and the power of the union's allies became more important than the power of the workers in the fields. And even though the workers in the fields were under contract, the union really didn't try to develop their sense of their own power, develop their own organization. So, for instance, one of the key things about the UFW is that there are no locals in the UFW. The UFW didn't have any locals. Instead, they had field offices, which were appointed by La Paz, by the center of the union, by the executive board. And without locals, workers didn't have ability to govern themselves, to run their own organization, to elect their representatives to be on the union staff. They could still be mobilized by the union, but they didn't have their own locus of strength. And so inside the UFW, what happened is the boycott tail came to wag the farm worker dog. And I think that's always a problem in any organization. It's a mixed class organization where you have working class people and then you have middle class people supporting them. And the middle class people have access to power, influence, money, which working class people don't. And sometimes they can come to dominate an organization, even though the organization is supposedly made up of farm workers. And because farm workers didn't have their own organizational base, their own locals, that's what came to happen in the UFW. In terms of the big picture, I think that is the answer.
Mm. Well, we have an email from Robert who says, is it true that the UFW's membership once reached a high of 100,000, but has since dwindled and remained around 5,000? If so, why is this?
Well, 5,000 figure is about accurate. The 100,000, I think, is a little bit exaggerated. It's very hard to number farm worker jobs because farm workers work at different jobs during the year. So a farm worker might go to one ranch and then go to another ranch and then you go to another ranch. So do you count that as three jobs or do you count that as one job? So I think the 100,000 figure is a bit high, but I mean, it was high. It was somewhere, I think, between 50 and 75,000. But it is true that it's now dwindled to five. And in terms of why is that, it just what happened was that the farm worker movement, which was not nurtured by the UFW, it dwindled and fell apart. And once the movement fell apart, then the grower offensive in the 1980s, when Duke Majan became governor, the grower offensive against the UFW attempt to wipe it out was successful, and there wasn't much fight back. The way they wiped it out was a fairly typical way. They just transferred their work from union ranches to non-union ranches, and the UFW wasn't able to stop it.
And I'd also like to ask you, Frank, we're going to a break in just a minute, to talk a little bit about the power you saw back in the 60s and 70s versus what you see today with farm workers. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're so vilified in the media and by politicians. There's all of these anti-immigration laws, and a lot of farm workers are afraid to speak up for themselves. Mm-hmm. So I think it'd be interesting to talk about just the differences you see between the 60s and 70s and today. And we'll talk about that after a break. We're speaking with Frank Bartike about his new book, Trampling Out the Vintage, Cesar Chavez and the Two Souls of the United Farm Workers. And we'd love to hear from you. What do you remember about the UFW, and why do you think it lost so much of its power? How can we support farm workers organizing today? After the break, we'll also talk about some victories that we're seeing this year. You can join us at 866-798-8255. If you worked on a farm or if you are involved with farms and farm workers, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can leave a comment, yourcallradio.org. We'll be back after this.
Back to your call in just a moment. Every week, thousands of listeners all over the Bay Area tune in to KALW, but not at 91.7 FM. They're using our online streams at kalw.org. Perhaps you travel outside the Bay Area or sometime encounter the limits of our signal strength. The online stream is a great way to stay connected. If you have a smartphone, you can listen on your iPhone, Android, or BlackBerry. Just click the Listen Live link at the top of our webpage at kalw.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there, maybe share a show with a friend, and sign up for our newsletter, yourcallradio.org, to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, Holly Kernan will have a conversation about how citizens are acting locally to stop foreclosures. We'll talk about the ongoing foreclosure crisis in California and find out how communities are creatively putting an end to evictions. That's tomorrow. On Thursday, we'll have a debate about President Obama's record thus far on the environment, healthcare, and U.S. foreign policy. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Frank Bartike. He is out with a new book, over 700 pages, called Trampling Out the Vintage, Cesar Chavez and the Two Souls of the United Farm Workers. It traces the rise and fall of the UFW. Frank spent 15 years writing this book. He was active in the student and anti-war movements in Berkeley in the 60s. He moved to California's Central Coast in 1970, worked for six seasons in the Salinas Valley fields, and spent 25 years teaching English to farm workers in the Watsonville area. And if you live in that area, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on these issues when you look at how much power farm workers had back in the 60s and then look at where they are today? In some cases, making $2 to $4 an hour. They're hoping to go to Sacramento on tomorrow, actually, to fight for this bill, AB 2346, that would prevent farm workers from dying from the summer heat. It would allow them to be able to enforce mandatory shade and drinking water requirements by taking delinquent employers to court in the tradition of a citizen's arrest. And you can find more information about this at yourcallradio.org. And we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. How are farm workers organizing and how can we support them? Do you ask if you go to a farmer's market how farm workers are treated? You can also leave a comment, yourcallradio.org. And we'll get to calls in just a minute, but just quickly, Frank, what are some of the main differences you remember from, you know, the 70s or talking to workers today who worked back then and the workers that are working on the fields today in terms of really using their power and using their voices?
A story about when I first worked in the fields in 1971, and I worked on a thinning crew. We thinned lettuce, basically. We worked with a short handle hoe. That was a year after the successful 1970 strike. That strike that I mentioned a little bit a while ago, where the growers couldn't cut and pack a single box of celery. It had been a very powerful strike. It had won several contracts in the Salinas Valley. And farm workers were feeling the strength of their organization and their movement. And when we worked in those fields, we would go to work in a bus. We were picked up, and we'd go to work in a bus. And if the farm workers thought that the field had been sprayed recently, they would refuse to get out of the bus. Wow. Nobody would leave the bus. The foreman would get up and say, we're not going to work until this field has been inspected. And that happened in the summer that I worked there. That happened three times, that the farm workers just simply refused to get off the bus. And people came out, and there were the growers, the bosses sent representatives out, and there was papers and discussions about whether there had been whether that field had been sprayed recently. And on two occasions, the workers were convinced that, in fact, it had not been sprayed recently, and we went to work. And in the other occasion, we actually did not work in that field that day. And we were paid for all the time we sat in the bus. Now, that's quite a powerful experience. Mm-hmm. I had come from the student movement, and I had been involved in student activities for a really long time. And on that summer in the fields, I had never seen the kind of sustained militant action among students. Students have militant actions for a while, and then it peters out. I hadn't seen the kind of sustained militant action among students that I saw in the fields that summer. It's one of the reasons that I stayed in the fields, because I liked it so much. Mm-hmm. I wanted to be a part of it. So now, today, I don't work in the fields now, so I can't give you the kind of firsthand information. But all I'm saying, well, I'll just repeat what I said before. Getting a law that bans pesticides is very important. And I certainly support it, and I urge people to go to Sacramento and support the law that is going to protect ensure that farm workers are protected from the heat. But it is not as effective as an organized militant group of workers who will refuse to leave a bus if they suspect that there's pesticides in the field.
Well, speaking of pesticides, Arista Life Science just recently pulled a cancer-causing methyl iodide off the United States market. It's been referred to as one of the most toxic chemicals on Earth, and UFW President Arturo Rodriguez recently said, quote, "Today farm workers can breathe a little bit easier knowing that the risk of being exposed to methyl iodide will be gone thanks to the support of thousands of people throughout the country and the brave workers who risk their jobs to speak out and say enough."
Yeah, that's true, although they still have to breathe methyl bromide.
Right, and so many other chemicals.
Yeah, which is just as much a killer as methyl iodide, which is being phased out, but phased out slowly. It has to do with the sort of the nature of strawberry production.
Mm-hmm.
Strawberry production involves what they do is they kind of sterilize the fields. They sterilize the fields with this methyl bromide. It's a fumigant that they put into the soil. And then they have these kind of fast-growing, highly productive plants that they've bred, which wouldn't know how to compete with other weeds or nematodes or things like that. That the sterilization kills, and that's how you get these very, very big strawberries. I think you've probably noticed the strawberries are really big. They're like small apples now,
right.
But they aren't very tasty, are they? They're kind of watery. And that comes from this style of production, which involves sterilizing the land, killing all of the natural competitors to the strawberry plant, and putting in a kind of strawberry plant that is kind of like strawberries on steroids.
Mm. Well, we've got a number of callers on the line, so let's go through a few, and then we'll get you to respond.
Sure.
Let's hear from Ted in Watsonville. Hi, Ted. Welcome to the show. Hello, Ted. Oh, sorry, Ted. Give us a call back, and we'll bump you to the front. Sorry, we lost you. Let's hear from Monica in Berkeley. Hi, Monica. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just tuned in about 10 minutes ago, so if this has already been brought up, I apologize. But as I was listening, and I am pretty familiar with the history of the UFW, I just wanted to make sure that all of your listeners out here in the Bay Area realize that there is a existent and very vital and vibrant model of farm worker organizing based out of South Florida, which is a huge agricultural area.
Yes.
And that's the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. They are very grassroots, very worker-oriented, and I'm originally from Florida, and I've spent a lot of time with the organization. And from what I've seen, there is no possibility that the boycott tail will ever come to wag the farm worker dog with this organization, as your guest said. And so I just wanted to make sure everybody knows they're locally based in South Florida, but they have successfully waged huge national campaigns against massive corporations. Taco Bell was the first victory, McDonald's, Subway. The most recent victory was Trader Joe's. So I really urge all the listeners to look into that organization. And their website is ciw-online.org. Definitely keep up with them. There's a lot of exciting things happening with that farm worker organization.
Thank you for bringing that up. We actually contacted the Coalition of Immokalee Workers to join us, but they're doing trainings on farms all day today. So unfortunately, they couldn't. And I'm really glad you brought up that victory, because we've got some questions for Frank about that, and we'll ask him in just a couple minutes. Thank you for calling in, Monica. Let's go next to Andrew in San Francisco. Hi, Andrew.
Hello. I wanted to ask about the Agricultural Labor Relations Act. I know that when the fields were finally organized, that the sort of the deal with the devil that was made was we sacrificed the ability that we had to wage a secondary boycott. Now, I understand that there was a problem, that's a very interesting question he raises, of the boycott wagging the dog. But nevertheless, it was the most powerful tool that we had, and it was the basis of a tremendous amount of community support. So now I wonder, is that act still on the books? And does that denial of the secondary boycott still exist? Because that would change a lot of things if we could boycott, if we could wage a secondary boycott yet again.
All right, thanks for the question. Frank, do you want to just take that one?
Yeah, the the law is still on the books, and I think that it wasn't exactly a deal with the devil. I think that the ALRA was actually a victory for farm workers, and what it prevented. People could still boycott. They could boycott individual commodities, but they could not, as the gentleman said, they couldn't boycott a store that was selling the individual commodities until they had won the right to a representative election. Once they won an election in the fields at a particular store, then they could engage in any kind of boycott that they wanted to. But they had to win that election first. So what it meant was that the growers couldn't sign a contract only under the pressure of a boycott. That there had to be an expression from the fields, the farm workers themselves. The majority of farm workers themselves wanted the union. Now, the reason that it was a victory for farm workers is because what was happening without such a law was wherever farm workers did win a contract, the Teamsters would come in, and as soon as the contract expired, the growers would sign with the Teamsters. And because there was no law saying that they couldn't without representation elections, the Teamsters were in fact replaced the UFW as the organization representing grape workers after 1973. And the UFW was out. So I think of it as a victory, the ALRA. Now, it is also true that the law by itself does not guarantee farm worker victories. There has to be a movement that enforces the law and which is capable of winning farm worker elections. And that is what's missing. I don't think it's a question of any weakness in the law.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. And why don't we spend some time talking about the Coalition of Immokalee Workers and this recent victory. Trader Joe's has about 367 stores across the country, and it's supporting the Fair Food Program, promoting social responsibility, really, in the produce industry. And so basically what this does is it provides an extra penny for every pound picked by the workers, for every pound of tomatoes picked by the workers. Is that right?
That's my understanding, and what it's the Immokalee. I mean, I don't know a hell of a lot about the Immokalee, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. I know somewhat, and as your caller said, it seems to me just from a distance that they have learned the lesson of the historical lesson of what happened to the UFW, and they seem to be quite conscious of keeping their primary focus on their rank and file rather than on the supporters who mean so much to them. That's how these things happen. It's not a question of sort of bad people or evil people who set out to mess up the farm worker movement. It's that if you depend a hell of a lot for your victories on your supporters, then you tend to be, there's a tendency to run your organization in terms of the interests of the supporters rather than the interests of the rank and file or in terms of the inclinations of the supporters rather than the inclinations of the rank and file.
And this would include about 4,000 tomato pickers.
Yeah.
We're talking an extra penny for every pound.
Well, I don't know how many pounds a picker picks in a day, so you really don't know how much that represents. It could represent quite a bit of quite a raise. I just want to say something the way they organize. You know, they don't have a union. What they do is that they have pressured the buyers, the people who buy the tomatoes. They have pressured them to not only force their people that they buy the tomatoes from, the ranchers that they buy the tomatoes from, to pay a penny more, but also to endorse a fair working condition code of conduct, which they will not buy any tomatoes from a farmer who doesn't endorse this code of conduct. Mm-hmm. Now, again, the code of conduct, like the law that I was talking about before, in and of itself doesn't really do much. But what the Immokalee workers have won through their struggle is the right to have the committee that goes out and inspects and enforces that code. So the Immokalee workers themselves are the people who enforce the code. So as I say, I've never worked in the Florida fields. All I know is about what I read about it and a few of the people from the coalition that I've talked to. But it sounds to me like they're on the right track.
It also establishes a cooperative complaint resolution system and a health and safety program. We have an email from a listener who said that I've been following this struggle in Florida, and I just wonder, it takes so long to build a movement around this. We're talking about a penny, and of course we don't know what that translates to. But the question is, why does it take so long to get an extra penny for every pound picked by the workers?
Well, the growers have a lot of power. I mean, I don't know how else to describe it. How long does it take teachers to fight the cutbacks? I mean, how long does it take communities to stop the shutting down of their libraries and their swimming pools? How long does it take us to stop the banks from foreclosing? I mean, these are social struggles, and they take a long time. And especially when you're talking about immigrant workers who are very often monolingual in Spanish and don't have much social weight in the society, even though they may have this periodic power on there in the fields. We're all in a really tough situation, and it's taking us all too long to win what we need to live decent lives. So farm workers are no different than anybody else in that respect.
We're speaking with Frank Bardaki. He's author of the new book, Trampling Out the Vintage, Cesar Chavez and the Two Souls of the United Farm Workers. And he traces the rise and fall of the UFW and Cesar Chavez. This book is based on 15 years of interviews. We've got about 10 minutes left, and we have open lines. So if you'd like to ask Frank a question or if you have a comment, we'd love to hear from you. If you work in the fields or have any experience on farms, what are your thoughts on where we are today, the most effective ways farm workers can organize, and how can we support them? 866-798-8255. And really, what role do we all play in this as we go shopping on a regular basis for our food? And are these issues that you think about, care about? Do you bring them up at farmers markets, for example? If you've gone to a Trader Joe's or a Whole Foods or any of these different stores, have you asked questions? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment, yourcallradio.org. And what about our role in all of this, Frank?
Well, I was hoping you were going to ask me that.
Okay, because I just wanted to give you one example. Our producer, Ali Budner, said that when all of this was going down with Trader Joe's, she got an email from the Immokalee Coalition and other organizations that said, do not go to Trader Joe's.
Yeah.
Help us win this victory. And then the next day, right the day after the announcement came down, it said, we love Trader Joe's. Go shopping at Trader Joe's. And she's thinking, well, do I go there or do I not? So what are your thoughts on this? What role do we play?
Well, I think that this is a really important question, because I think that one of the things that folks have to realize is that as consumers in support of farm worker struggle, that we have a secondary role to play. It doesn't mean that it is an important role, but it is secondary, that we're not going to win farm worker struggles for them. The only way that farm workers are going to really win a whole series of victories which seriously improves their lives is if they build their own organization and their own movement. And once they have their own organization and their own movement, then we have an important role to play. Not that we're going to wait. I mean, I honor Immokalee boycotts. I think it's important to honor Immokalee boycotts, and I think, you know, a boycott can be won, and then the boycott is pulled off. I don't think there's anything strange about that. But there should be some modesty in terms of our own conception of what we can do to help farm workers. Farm workers basically have to help themselves, and when in the process of helping themselves, we can aid, but we're not the crucial actors. You know, we are really the crucial actors in our own communities, in the places that your kids go to school, or at the local city hall, or wherever you work. That's where you are the main actor. That's where you are. That's where the most important struggle is for you, is in your own job, in your own life, in your own community. And that's where you can be the primary, together with your fellow citizens and fellow workers, the primary engine of struggle. not as supporters of other people's movements.
All right. Well, we've got a couple more calls. So let's hear from John in Santa Cruz. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for the show. This is terrific and right on time in so many ways. I just wanted to tell a brief anecdote that follows on to what you were just saying. I was a little kid in the late 60s in central Wisconsin, in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, when going downtown with my father on a bitterly cold early winter day, we encountered two Latino men in cowboy boots and much too thin jackets handing out leaflets asking us to ban, to follow the boycott on grapes. And their informational on the leaflet was that brandy was a hugely popular drink in Wisconsin, particularly in Portage County, and they were targeting Portage County because a very high percentage of the brandy made in the country was consumed in that county. And this is central Wisconsin. No one there knew that brandy was made from grapes. But it was a tremendous example to me, and it stayed with me all these years as an example of raising awareness, both raising the farm workers' awareness of where their crops were going and what they were doing in the country, and consumer awareness about what foods they were consuming and where they were coming from. That's my story.
Well, it's a great story. Thank you, John. We'll get a response in just a minute. Let's hear from Meredith in San Francisco. Hi, Meredith.
Hi. You know, I think it's great that we're talking about treating farm workers well and doing the right thing in this country. But as a consumer base, we've got to realize that part of the problem is the huge demand that is now existing for foreign produce and the way it pushes prices down. And let's remember that the workers who are picking in other parts of the world are treated more poorly, and the toxins that are used are worse. And yet we will jump up and down about the conditions for migrant workers in this country, and yet we buy produce from all over the world that sits on boats and in trucks and on trains. And that's got to be addressed, because we can't, as consumers, look one way and then look the other way because we want cheap produce.
Right.
Buy local produce, buy it in season, know where it's farmed, and know how it's picked.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's a great point. We just did a show about this a couple of weeks ago. And to your point, Ron writes, for 15 years I taught in the Morgan Hill Unified School District, and one of my students was a granddaughter of Cesar Chavez and a citizen. But large numbers of migrant children were, quote, seasonal students coming in and going across the border. According to the crops, it was so hard for these kids to get an academic footing and for teachers to assist them in that effort. And I'm so glad you brought this up, Ron. It's important to point out that 500,000 children work in the fields in the United States. They're the least protected of all working children. And this is according to the Children in the Fields campaign. And we'll get Frank to comment on this in just a minute. We've got time for one more caller, Pam in San Francisco. Hi, Pam.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I was here in San Francisco during the period of the Great Boycott and went to a lot of marches. And I just wondered if the author there had the same experience that I did, was that I thought that the people that the farm workers reached out to in cities tended to be middle class. That was very interesting that they didn't have locals, and that was part of the problem, but that also they did not reach out to or appeal to the working class in the cities. And the people who were marching were middle-class people. And I felt like that was a fatal flaw. They needed to find a way to reach out to the working class, to the unions in the cities.
Frank?
Yes, well, to a certain extent, that's true. They had a very, very wide coalition in the 1960s. And that coalition included middle-class consumers, and it included students, and it included the emergent Chicano people, people who had a new conception of themselves as Chicano. And it included religious people. But it also did include labor unions. Now, in fact, the UFW was sustained for many years by contributions from the United Automobile Workers Union. Now, those decisions were made by the UAW, United Automobile Workers Union, officialdom, but maybe not by rank and file auto workers, nonetheless, they did reach out to unions. And not even that. I would even have to correct that. In Los Angeles, at the at the big Chrysler plant that used to be in Los Angeles, which is now closed down and no longer exists, there was a constant picket line and fund donation by automobile workers to the UFW, and automobile workers were paying so much a week to sustain the UFW. So I think that they did have a very wide coalition.
And Frank, I'm sorry to cut you off. We're almost out of time.
Yeah, sure.
I just want to ask you, is part of the problem today that a lot of the farm workers are undocumented and they fear that they're going to be deported?
Well, a lot of farm workers were undocumented back in the day, too. In the 1970s. And there was a fear that they were going to be deported, and the mechanization of deportation is so much stronger. The militarization of the border is so much more effective today than it was back then. But again, a strong farm worker movement can overcome the problems of undocumented, as has been proven in Los Angeles among the janitors and among the washeros right now, and also among the people years ago who were building the mobile homes. All those people are heavily undocumented, and because they had a strong movement, they were able to beat back ICE and beat back the MIGRA.
And we have a lot of questions about organic farms and how workers are treated. We've only got 30 seconds. Just quickly on that, and then what's next?
You know what? We should do another talk about that, because that is a really big issue, the question of how workers are treated on organic farms. Obviously, they don't have to soak up pesticides all day long, and that's terribly important. But on issues of wages, and it doesn't really make that much difference. And I can tell that's a whole long discussion.
Well, and I'm sure you've got another hour in you to talk about this. We're only on page 200 at this point. We've got 500 left.
Well, people shouldn't be scared by how long it is. It's a good read.
It is a good read. Thank you so much. Frank Bartike is author of Trampling Out the Vintage. Thank you so much for joining us, Frank.
Hey, thank you very much.
Thank you, and thanks for your phone calls and emails.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. How are citizens acting locally to stop foreclosures? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about the response to the foreclosure crisis in California. In San Francisco, Occupy Bernal activists have successfully postponed 6 housing auctions. Citizens in cities across the country are working on this issue. Activists in San Francisco are working on a citywide foreclosure and eviction moratorium. How are communities creatively stopping evictions? It's Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.